Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. That war is, of course, a multifaceted thing. It has dimensions of it that are clearly in the kinetic space, as they say, the old-fashioned warfare, kind of military warfare, and then many others as well. A man who has been studying and practicing warfare in both the kinetic sense and others is our guest. I'm very pleased to say for a full hour. He is Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, United States Marine Corps retired, now a senior research fellow specializing in defense programs at the Allison Center for Foreign and National Security Policy of the Heritage Foundation. He, for two decades, served in the United States Marine Corps, engaged in, as I say, both the old-fashioned kind of warfare and what goes into it, the planning, the logistics, the detailed work that enables our military to prevail, please God, in the future as it has in the past. Dakota Wood has graciously joined us in the past to talk about all of these matters of preparedness, where the military is today, where it will likely be in the future, and has, as I say, very generously agreed to talk with us for a full hour about all of this and more. Dakota, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Right. It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me back on.
Well, let's start this hour-long drill down on where we are and where we're likely to find ourselves in the future by talking a bit about the threat environment. As a strategic planner, this is something you know is the kind of backdrop against which these sorts of things have to be considered. Maybe we could start by sort of discussing several of the key vectors of the threat that we're confronting at the moment. The Secretary of the Air Force, I was struck by a comment the other day, actually allowed us how it sounded a lot like she was channeling Mitt Romney, that Russia was the greatest threat, in her judgment, that we face today. Is that so in your judgment? And if so, why?
Well, it's almost a time horizon issue when you think about what's the greatest threat. For a lot of people, they'll think that terrorism is the greatest threat because it's immediate. You can, a suicide bomber can detonate a vest in Times Square, and that's, that's a bad day. Others will say, look, these long-term profound threats, such as posed by Russia or China because of deep nuclear arsenals and a large state apparatus that can harness, state-level power and military forces that affect regions is a more worrisome threat because of its scope and its duration. So I think you really have to separate these into kind of an immediate, midterm, and long-term set of issues because our response mechanisms to those differ. Terrorism, law enforcement, special operations forces, there are ways that we can deal with that. Diplomatic alliances that deny a terrorist element a sanctuary in which they can plan, train, and launch attacks. But you need a very large military force built over years, very expensive to maintain, to deter, stand up against profound threats like Russia. So it's kind of one of those, it depends on the nature of the issue. I'm most concerned about these larger, more profound threats like Russia, that you have an aspirational Iran that could serve the same kind of challenge in the Middle East and all that that implies. And then certainly China is seeking to be the regional hegemon in the Asia-Pacific region. So that's where I wish we would tend to focus. And if you can get the big power competitions right, then a lot of the other things can be sorted out.
Let me ask you about each of those in turn, if I may, Dakota. Starting with Russia, the deep nuclear force capability is something that most of us have long since forgotten about, or at least stopped being preoccupied by. And yet, there seems to be growing evidence that Vladimir Putin is not only rhetorically threatening the use of nuclear weapons, but it seems is making a concerted effort to practice in their use. And therefore, when you combine that with the kind of investment that the Russians have been making for, well, decades now, but particularly of late, it would add up, it seems to me, to be a quite ominous situation. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, he's really trying to keep the eastern part of Europe essentially destabilized, and the western part with Germany, France, Britain, in other words, intimidated. And a mechanism to do that is to have these very short notice snap exercises where large numbers of forces are mobilized in proximity to, say, the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Belarus, Ukraine, to do very provocative actions in the Baltic Sea with submarine movements into territorial waters of Sweden and Norway and others. And those that analyze the types of things that Russia is doing, interpret those as also the things that you would want to do if you were to employ nuclear weapons. So you're kind of practicing all the mechanisms, without actually introducing a particular weapon into that exercise. And it's clear telegraphing. I mean, he's testing his own forces. What can they do? But it's sending a message to powers in Europe and then broader. What was that? How does it influence actions in the Middle East as well and other things? So very aggressive. Invested a lot.
Let me ask you about Sweden. You mentioned Sweden. The chief of the general staff in Sweden, as you may know, Dakota Wood, responded to some of these exercises and threatening conduct by the Russians, saying he thought Sweden, this nation that has long been proud of its stance as a neutral, would be at war sometime in the next few years. This is a really stunning sort of change in the geostrategic environment, if he has reason to fear that. Let me turn to China. You have alluded to its ambitions as a regional hegemon. Give us a flavor of the kinds of capabilities that the Chinese are putting into place that would enable them to not only aspire to that, but perhaps be able to enjoy it, if not actually be able to project power quite a bit beyond their region.
Well, you have rhetoric, you have written items like white papers and doctrine, you have organizational indicators, and then you actually have material capabilities. So previously, in years past, China was pretty much inward-looking, concerned about domestic security issues, border integrity. It's always dealt with kind of a restive hinterland, and its military, the People's Liberation Army, was a direct arm of the Communist Party and was very much focused on this internal and peripheral security. In the past year or two, though, the China has become much more outward-looking. So the white paper that it issued in this past year, its recently announced reorganization of its military departments and what their duties and tasks are, and then its investment in its military capabilities all indicate an outward-looking, more expansionist military perspective and a geopolitical perspective. So as China has matured in its economy, it's become more dependent on external sources of supply for energy, like oil, for example, that comes out of the Persian Gulf. So if you see where China is at on map, and you look at all the water space that leads back to Iran and Saudi Arabia and other oil producers, it has a very long, vulnerable sea line of communication, a SLOC, that extends through the Arabian Sea, around India, Bay of Bengal, Malaysia, South China Sea, et cetera. And so it's concerned about that. So it needs a navy that can protect its economic interests. It needs an outward-looking military that can coerce its claims in the South and East China Seas. And it's being very, very muscular in how it invests accordingly. It has an aircraft carrier. It's building a second, improving its submarine capabilities, continuing to improve its long-range missile capabilities, and it's fielding its own latest-generation military aircraft, largely through cyber espionage, that's acquired trade secrets and designs, et cetera, from the Americans. with all these cyber attacks and intrusions. But they're very muscular and very outward and very aggressive, and that's what countries in that region are concerned about.
We're going to talk more with Dakota Wood of the Heritage Foundation, the editor of a marvelous and very, very valuable resource, the 2016 Index of U.S. Military Strength, about China and about other adversaries this country faces and what we had better be about doing to contend with them, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleischer with the Center for Security Policy. The newest twist in the Hillary Clinton email scandal was the discovery of top-secret SAP material in unclassified emails on her private email server. SAP stands for Special Access Program. This was extremely sensitive information above the top-secret level, the compromise of which could cause loss of life and severe damage to U.S. national security. This was not the first report of classified information on Clinton's server. So what are the chances that hostile intelligence services hacked Clinton's email server? Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates thinks the odds are pretty high that countries like Iran, China, and Russia did hack this server. So how did this happen? The reason is that Hillary Clinton didn't think laws on official email and protecting classified information applied to her. If elected president this fall, Clinton will bring the same kind of dangerous arrogance to the White House. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting for a full hour with one of the nation's most astute analysts and strategic thinkers when it comes to our military, the challenges it's facing, and what we had better be doing to ensure that it's up to them. He is Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, United States Marine Corps retired, now a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. But he comes to that with two decades of work in the Marine Corps, including in its headquarters, planning and executing plans for our nation's security. And Dakota, you were just going through a very illuminating analysis of what China is up to and how its sea lines of communication are extending the areas of operation that it must cover as it sees it, including with a new base, I gather, they're building in Djibouti that would give them the ability to project power into much of that ocean area that you're talking about they're concerned about. But I'd like to also ask, as you see it, about their nuclear program as well. I know they're very cagey about the extent of it, not quite as direct in their threats, though periodically there have been occasional threats from the Chinese on their nuclear fronts. But what do you make of what they're up to in that area and what it might mean, again, for American security?
Yeah, exactly right in terms of being cagey and how they kind of hold or play their cards very close to the vest, as opposed to some of the other countries, North Korea and Iran, aspirational developing those capabilities. But it appears that China is getting very serious about maturing their capabilities, and that the Second Artillery used to be the organization that controlled these strategic nuclear arms. And again, in this past year, they've reorganized and retitled it and given it more prominence as a standalone organization, something apart from or different than the conventional PLA forces. So I think it's indicative of the seriousness with which they approach this capability, the maturing of their command and control structures. We the U.S., have done a lot to try to understand the decision-making processes and the systems that the Chinese would use to employ nuclear weapons, but they're very close hold on that stuff, and it's difficult to ferret that out. But again, raising their strategic forces to the level that they are indicates the seriousness.
Our guest is Dakota Wood of the Heritage Foundation, the editor of the 2016 Index of U.S. Military Strength. You know, there's one other facet of this that fascinates and frankly alarms me, and that is the reported investment they've made in something on the order of 3,000 miles of underground hardened tunnels, in which apparently they deploy God only knows what, presumably nuclear weapons and the missiles with which to deliver them, among other things. What is your take on what that says about their commitment to this nuclear enterprise, not necessarily in the deterrent mode, but perhaps of an offensive character as well?
Yeah, with countries that do such extensive tunneling, Iraq was into that. Iran is certainly invested in that. Russia, to a limited extent. But the Chinese really take the cake in their tunneling capabilities and expertise. But you can do things in secret with vast underground complexes. So, you know, missile assembly, development, testing, maintenance, all that stuff can occur out of sight of satellites or human intelligence operatives. It also allows you to ready capabilities in secret without external kinds of activities that might alert somebody like the United States that something is going on. And it also, by virtue of the tunneling and embedding things in mountain sizes, hardens your facilities, which gives you a survivable second strike capability. If you, you know, you think back, you've got this experience, the old Cold War doctrine. It wasn't just the first salvo, but you had to be able to take a hit from your opponent and have a second strike option as well. And the Chinese have certainly developed that. So secrecy, security, second strike, which means that it's not just a defensive posture, but they retain the ability to actually engage in some kind of a significant exchange if it came to that. And so that has both a deterrent value that hopefully prevents somebody from attacking you, or if it does ratchet up, then your potential opponent has to be concerned about all of his land, you know, being vulnerable to a strike, you know, that you can't take out your enemy's capabilities in one full swoop.
Dakota, if you would talk about the Chinese activities in space and what you think that portends, particularly for a nation like ours, which is so dependent on space for both civilian and military purposes.
Right. So there's a couple, three things. One is the anti-satellite capability. So if the United States is always playing the away game, our forces are deployed thousands of miles from home, critically reliant on satellite-based communications or exchanging the kinds of information that allow precision-guided warfare, as the U.S. practices it, to occur, you know, to command and control widely distributed forces. So if China could neutralize that capability, both by taking out the communications relays, overhead satellite imagery, and the PNT, the precision navigation and timing capabilities that allow GPS-guided things to happen, it certainly keeps the U.S. from conducting operations. So they have been testing. If you remember a couple of years ago, they did a shot that supposedly they were taking out an aging weather satellite, but most analysts believe it was a test of an anti-satellite missile that could be used in a military conflict. So they've certainly developed that capability, the ability to blind and dazzle as well. The second one is their own communications network, as well as their GPS equivalent, the Beta Owl system. And I believe they just had a recent launch here, which all but completed that satellite architecture, which gives them something that's independent of a U.S.-driven GPS satellite architecture that provides global coverage. So the Beta Owl system handles everything over the Asia region, Asia Pacific, extending down into the Australia area, and it would enable the Chinese to conduct independent operations in a state of heightened conflict.
And in terms of their larger ambitions in space, do you see military dominance of the heavens, perhaps as a platform from which to attack the Earth, also being part of what they have in mind?
Well, there have been discussions on that, you know, as well as manned space programs, but certainly this weaponizing of the heavens has been discussed. I don't know the extent to which that they have attempted to do that, you know, clandestine or a covert mode, but it's certainly been discussed. And there has been this agreement among the space-capable powers that outer space would not be weaponized, but that's, you know, that's goodwill. I mean, there's nothing preventing somebody from doing that. It certainly has our planners concerned.
The space capable powers, as you put it, now include North Korea. They recently launched, as you know, a satellite that overflew the Super Bowl site. Dakota Wood, as you look at North Korea and its nuclear weapons tests and more generally what that so-called hermit kingdom is up to, how would you characterize it as a problem for the United States?
Very aggressive. You know, they have military powers prized, so their people starve while they're building weapons. And this latest launch, again, interpreted as not just putting a usable satellite up, but the missile technology that makes that possible, which extends the range of their ballistic missile capabilities to something like 13,000 kilometers, covers the entire United States and on down into Central America. So if you combine that with their atomic or nuclear program, they would then have a missile capable of taking a nuclear warhead to any target within the United States. So it's a worrisome development. There's also the potential of that nuclear package being used as an EMP weapon, and the U.S. so critically dependent on electronics. Again, it's another thing in their arsenal.
We'll be right back with more with Dakota Wood and what we need to be doing about these threats and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. North Korea observed the 50th Super Bowl by orbiting a satellite over the stadium shortly after the last quarter ended. The ability of a bankrupt totalitarian regime to achieve such a feat, even briefly, would be something of a marvel if it were not so ominous. Two prominent experts, former Clinton Director of Central Intelligence James Woolsey and CIA veteran Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, have warned that such satellites could be used by the North Koreans to deliver a catastrophic attack against this country's electric grid. By detonating a nuclear weapon at the altitude of a satellite in low Earth orbit, an attacker could blanket most of the United States with devastating electromagnetic pulses. It turns out, the Russians gave Pyongyang a design for a super EMP weapon. Fortunately, it wasn't used Sunday night. We must protect our grid against future attacks. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're having a very special conversation with a very thoughtful guy about our national security. He is Dakota Wood. He served with great distinction in the United States Marine Corps, rising to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. He now associated with the Heritage Foundation, where, among other good works, he has recently published as its editor the 2016 Index of U.S. Military Strength. Its subtitle is very important: Assessing America's Ability to Provide for the Common Defense. And Dakota, in the previous two segments, you've talked about the challenges to the common defense, and we've only lightly touched on some of them, I'm afraid, but we've nonetheless gotten a pretty compelling picture that this is a dangerous world and likely to become considerably more so as some of the adversaries that you've described are certainly going to be continuing to build up their offensive capabilities, conventional, nuclear, space, asymmetric, and the like. I'd like to talk with you about our capabilities. You've been studying this closely, of course, for your index, but also in your past incarnation and present. Start with the readiness of the forces we have. While he took a lot of crap for it, Don Rumsfeld famously said, you go to war with the army you have. How is that army and Air Force and Marine Corps and Navy shaping up today as you see it?
We think they're in a fairly marginal to weak status when you look at what they're asked to do and you look at the individual service standards for what they determined to be combat ready, you know, could a force go out the door to accomplish a military task. Chief of Staff of the Army is on record saying that one-third of the Army meets that readiness capability. So that's one-third of the existing Army. Our assessment indicates that the existing Army we have is only two-thirds of the size that it needs to be. So you have an Army that is undersized to begin with, and within that undersized Army, only a third of that is ready to go. So just, back in 2012, they had 45 brigades, which was necessary to provide, you know, a supporting rotational base to handle just the operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is not a near-peer competitor or anything like that, right? Just recently, they folded the flag on one of their latest brigades. They're now down to 31. So in the space of about 3.5 years, we've moved from 45 brigades down to 31 brigades, and only about 10 or 12 of those are actually at acceptable levels of readiness. So I think it's an indicator of the impact that the Budget Control Act has had, sequestration, you know, the reduced expenditure of funds investing in the nation's defense.
And I take it that similar kinds of conditions apply in the other services as well, maybe perhaps to a somewhat lesser degree, but that we are both undersized and inadequately ready.
You know, and readiness becomes ever more important the smaller the force gets. So if you don't have much to begin with, relative to a global power that truly has global interests, again, Cold War, we were up against a global competitor. That competitor, the Soviet Union, is no longer there. But the world remains the same size, and now we have a diverse array of competitors, China, Iran, North Korea, Russia. So you still need a global force. So the smaller that becomes, then it's more important for each one of those pieces to be that much more ready. And unfortunately, we have the reverse of that. So we've got a shrinking military. We need about 345 ships. We have 272. We need an army of 45 to 50 brigades. We have an army of 31 brigades. We had a Marine Corps of 27 battalions. They're now down to 23 and potentially shrinking further than that. It used to be that for the Air Force, a pilot to maintain combat proficiency would have to fly about 200 hours a year. In some squadrons, that's much reduced, and when you drop below 150 hours, the pilot is deemed non-combat deployable or capable. You wouldn't put them in a combat situation. And so the Secretary of the Air Force last spring, we'll see new testimony this spring, testified about reduced levels of readiness. Again, about a third of squadrons or thereabouts were actually up to combat levels of capability. So we're just in a fairly dire situation, which is odd given how much money we spend. But we're trying to maintain a world-class military force that is globally distributed against a globalized threat. And if you want people to be successful in the tasks you provide them and to come back home safely, they simply have to fly, drive, sail, and shoot rounds at ranges. And again, with the reduced funding, they're not able to do that. So each of the service chiefs are very concerned about the readiness of their shrinking force and the ability to prepare that force for future taskings.
This is troubling on so many different levels. For one thing, as you know, Dakota Wood, so well, we are still at war to some degree, and there's a lot of talk about being more so in the future, particularly among certain presidential campaigns. As you look at this, Dakota, are you struck by the fact that the condition of the United States military can only be further emboldening adversaries? And what you've already described is bad enough, but if they are convinced that we're actually dismantling such deterrent as we have to them, shouldn't we expect them to behave even more aggressively and badly elsewhere in the future?
Yeah, Frank, I mean, that is the heart of the matter. It truly is. It's not military power for military power. It's if we want a secure economy, if we want jobs, if we want, you know, economic vitality and cultural vitality, you have to be secure from other powers or interests that want to impose their view of life on their regions that affect, ripple back to affect the United States. So we want access to markets, be able to sell our goods and services, get access to raw material. And where powers like Russia and China and others expand their influence, it's reduced opportunity and reduced security for the United States. So when we take a kind of a submissive posture, when the perception is that we're weak, that we can't commit to something, that we're not there in strength and support of friends and allies, exactly as you said, it emboldens and encourages aggressive and provocative behaviors by our competitors who will move into those areas. So if you're Japan or the Philippines or Vietnam, where is the United States in trying to help push back? Because individually or even collectively, these are such small countries that can't do much against these big, larger powers. Germany's army, its total army, is only 60,000 strong. The Royal Navy of old only has about 17 surface combatants. So they have made bad choices over the last 20 or so years and are malpositioned to be able to stand up.
Dakota, let me ask you about this. You used a nice euphemism. Their view of life, I think, is the way you described what others may be trying to impose on us. It may actually be an end to our lives. And what I think it's so important, especially somebody with your military expertise and background, to bring home to the rest of us is when we have a military in this condition and we have enemies that are on the march, that does translate very likely into a loss of life, certainly of men and women in uniform, needlessly, and quite possibly a lot of the rest of us as well, doesn't it?
The Europeans are seeing this firsthand with the flood of migrants out of Syria and other countries, North Africa and Central Asia, into Europe, where in a Western ideal, you want to open your arms, invite people in, help them out, give them a better life. And what they didn't account for is dramatic differences in cultures, where people are coming from in terms of value systems, you know, their belief of what's right and wrong and appropriate, what is permissible. So if a young woman is walking down the street unaccompanied by a male, obviously, you know, she is a harlot and it's perfectly fine to attack her. I mean, these are the stories coming out of the capital cities and small towns of Europe. So my point is, you know, these cultural differences and different value systems and different way of living that stretch back centuries, if not 2,000 or 3,000 years, has to be accounted for in how we interact with the world. So, you know, we feel we're advanced. We've got a particular culture that's derived from a European basis and all that. But it's false to simply assume that the rest of the world operates that way. You know, Boko Haram in Africa, Islamic State in the Middle East. I mean, there are these other elements out there that are very aggressive and confident and very violent in imposing their will on others. And if we ignore that, we'll suffer the consequences.
Dakota Wood, we're going to talk about modernizing our military, the investments that are required for it, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back in this most illuminating and frankly very troubling conversation about the condition of the United States military and its ability to contend with a host of threats that are now arising. Some of them have been emerging for some time. Some of them seem to be coming out of the blue. But all of them are a problem, and we're discussing those and what now we must do about them with Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, United States Marine Corps retired, now a senior research fellow on defense programs at the Heritage Foundation. I can't say enough about how important I think is his most recent contribution from the Heritage Foundation, its 2016 Index of U.S. Military Strength. assessing America's ability to provide for the common defense. So, Dakota, let's cut to the chase. We have threats abounding. We have serious shortfalls. What, as you look at this, is needed now in terms of remedying not just the readiness shortfalls, but the future force structure and equipment needs of the United States military?
Well, it all starts with funding. Funding should be commensurate with U.S. national security interests. So if we have interests around the world and you want to be able to defend those interests, you then envision the military capabilities as the military component of national power amongst diplomacy and others. And then you associate the resources necessary to have that military capability to secure those interests. So this is going to sound wonky, but I think it's important to provide some references. During the Cold War, we averaged right around 7% of GDP over several decades from the 1940s on. So that just gave you an idea of how important national security was relative to U.S. economic power. Over the last 40 years, that's still been nearly 4.5% of GDP. Where we're currently at now is somewhere around 3.2%. So on a 40-year average, on an $18 trillion economy, we would still be well up into the $800 billion range for spending on defense. If you were at 4%, it's like $720 billion. Bob Gates, in his last budget, had estimated that this year would be spending around $650 billion. The baseline imposed by the Budget Control Act keeps us at around $500 billion. So if we're currently at a legally limited $500 billion plus a little bit for your baseline funding against Bob Gates, $650 against a 4% average of $720. You see where I'm heading on that? We're like $150 or $200 billion per year less than what the United States has historically thought was necessary to secure its interests on a global basis. So the military services are having to deal with these fairly dramatic reductions in spending, which sounds completely goofy since it's so much money that's involved. But the fighters and the tanks and the ships and the communications gear, et cetera, of today are much more capable, but they're more complicated, more complex to give you that capability, and therefore they're more expensive. You know, we want to retaining an all-volunteer force. I mean, it's just an expensive thing to do. And it's not that we're global policemen and seeing after everybody's interests. This should be very self-centered in securing our interests. And to the extent that we make ourselves dependent on what other people are doing, we're actually introducing vulnerabilities into our own security calculations.
You know, on that point, I want to just draw you out on something, Dakota. We're told by the American media, by some former defense officials like Larry Korb, the president himself lately, that, you know, we're spending more on defense, even at these lower levels, than X number of other countries, pick your number, 8, 10 combined. And one thing that I wanted to just ask you about is whenever somebody says that, it always occurs to me, the police spend considerably more than criminals do for the purpose of protecting our society, our people, our lives against those criminals and their misconduct. Without getting into, are we the world's policemen? Just as you say, having global interests, protecting those interests is inherently a more expensive thing than putting them at risk, isn't it?
Right. So the argument in one way says if everybody else wants to be weak, then we should be weak too. So if the NATO target is 2% of GDP, well, clearly we're above that. But most of the NATO members, 24 of the 28, are below that. Most are in the 1.2% range spending on security. So when you line up that we spend as much as the next 10, and most of those are allies, look at what our allies are actually spending. And if they were spending what they should be spending, then we would be spending as much as the next 5 or 6. You see what I mean? And these are regional, local powers, they're not global powers. So the difference is so great because other people have made very, very bad decisions and have very weakened national security states. We don't want to peg our spending to to the poor decisions and poor posture of other people.
Or to rely on them to make up our shortfalls either.
Absolutely. You know, we talked about what Germany and France and England have, you know, and if we're going to be dependent on these others to stand up against Russia or China or North Korea, then we're making ourselves vulnerable just out of spite. So right now, the defense budget is about 16% of the federal budget writ large. And yet that 16% of the budget had to absorb half, 50% of the Budget Control Act cuts. So it's $1 trillion in reduced spending over a 10-year period. I mean, it's just our priorities are completely out of whack.
Those $200 billion or so shortfalls per annum come on top of about $1 trillion, as I understand it, that's already gone out of the defense budget. So we find ourselves with this yawning underinvestment. And you've described, you know, what that's meaning in today's forces. But what will we need to do, based on your analysis, Dakota Wood of the Heritage Foundation, to rectify this situation so that the next president in the country under his or her leadership isn't going to continue to run the risks we currently are?
Yeah, it's going to have to be a Reagan-esque buildup. So Jimmy Carter, at the end of his administration, realized how weakened he had allowed the military to get and kind of started that. Ronald Reagan came into office and said, look, if we don't do something now in a dramatic fashion, then the Soviet Union is going to ride roughshod off of Europe. Just going to push us off the world scene. And it's not a pride privilege thing. It's the way of life, economic vitality, and really standing for the for what the United States has stood for so long, right? I mean, that's what's really at stake. So the current administration, this budget that will be released today, has a base of about $550 billion. If we were at Cold War, I mean, at the last averages, the last 40 years, it would be about $200 billion more, around $774 billion. So we've got to start buying back capacity. We can't wear out the force at the rate that we have been wearing it out. You know, when I have fewer planes, the fewer planes I have are being used up faster. So capacity is a big deal. We have to invest in readiness. And then I think we need to invest in an experimentation force to better prepare us to be more adept at exploiting technological advances than what our competitors are going to be able to do. So if we want to stay ahead of the next step ahead, we have to be investing in experimentation now so that we're prepared for the tasks 10 or 15 years from now.
So to summarize here, just very briefly, you're talking about a very substantial increase in investment. That investment has to go to getting the readiness back up, getting people training again at the levels that assure their proficiency. You're going to have to make investments in the ships and the planes and the tanks and the missiles that are the backbone of our military. In other words, it's a huge, huge challenge. Dakota Wood, we'll come back with our final block, and we'll talk about the kinds of support systems that are needed to be maintained as well and rebuilt, including for our nuclear deterrent. That and more with Dakota Wood. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
You are joining us for the final installment of a very important conversation with a serious planner, a strategic thinker, a man with expertise both in uniform and now in civilian life at the Heritage Foundation in thinking through what's really necessary to provide for the common defense. That is a subtitle of his newest book, 2016 Index of U.S. Military Strength. You really need to check this out, folks. It is a comprehensive analysis of the things that we're talking about here. where our shortfalls exist and what that might mean in terms of loss of lives needlessly on the part of our men and women who serve us in uniform, but perhaps also the rest of us as well. Dakota Wood is his name. It is always a pleasure to have him with us, and I appreciate so much this extended interview with you, Dakota. We've been talking about a number of different elements of the inadequacies, I guess you'd call them, of our national security posture. I do want to spend a moment or two talking about what is arguably the single most important part of that national security posture, the nuclear forces. What's your current reading on them, and what needs to be done to ensure their future effectiveness?
Yeah, it's moribund at the moment. I mean, we haven't done any kind of tests in almost 25 years. Meanwhile, China, Russia, North Korea, Iran have very active programs.
These are underground nuclear tests, of course, you're referring to there.
Yeah, of any type. I mean, even a finished, you know, not just a finished weapon, but, you know, triggering mechanisms and these kinds of things. So almost everything we do now is computer modeling and simulation. But the math behind those models derives from when we had active testing going on in the 1960s and 70s. Which was supposed to say, indicate, do weapons work as advertised. It was not meant to capture data for future weapons on down the road. So when you have an industry or a sector that isn't doing anything innovative, there's no new work coming out of it, it's very hard to attract and retain new talent. So your intellectual capacity is eroding within the nuclear enterprise. It's very static. The designs we have are very old, and we're just betting that everything works as it's intended to work. And I think one manifestation of the state of affairs is the continual problems the nuclear community has had with just simple human error, you know, flying weapons that weren't supposed to be flown, cheating exam scandals when people were getting their certifications, failed testing inspections in some of the missile silos. It just indicates a morale and an attitude problem in that community because it's been this back burner. So we've got an infrastructure that is dramatically underfunded, no new design work, and a problem with maintaining expertise.
As you look at what's happening around the world and then address yourself to what it's going to take for us, say we don't even try to undertake a Reagan-style buildup, but a more modest one, does the industrial capacity of this country exist now to generate the kinds of quantities of fighters and missiles and ships and so on that we, I think quite rightly you say, need?
No, if it takes 2 or 3 years to build a ship and you're not building very many ships and you don't have enough shipyards to really expand in the event of a major war. So we have now an attrition-sensitive force, meaning if we were to actually go into battle against a credible opponent and start taking combat losses in ships and airplanes, we would be very hard-pressed to replace those at a rate sufficient to sustain operations over time. So you're talking about short-duration wars because you just can't take losses because you can't replace those losses when they occur, right? So right now we have one plant in Lima, Ohio, that makes main battle tanks. That's it in the entire country. The F-35 is produced at one production line in Fort Worth, Texas. That's it, and that is the future airplane for our manned fighter fleet. We have two shipyards that produce submarines. We've got, I think, two shipyards that produce aircraft carriers. So because of the lack of competition and this winner-take-all approach we've had to acquisition, once somebody wins a contract, and we're not producing many of something because we've got a smaller force, it forces other people out of that business. With the bomber contract, if Northrop Grumman doesn't win that, they'll basically be out of the manned aircraft business if Lockheed Martin and Boeing win it. So we see the shrinkage of the industrial base. It's brittle. Cannot surge in capacity, and the ripple effect then is to our forces not being able to take losses, you know, with the consequence of not being able to sustain operations over time.
Dakota Wood, as a man who has served in uniform for some 20 years, there is one other aspect of this. You sort of alluded to the costs of the all-volunteer force being very high. There is a real concern, it seems to me, I sense both in the armed forces themselves and certainly among those of us outside who admire and respect and value so much what they do, that we're not only in the process of wrecking the military in all the ways you've described to this point, but that this, well, for want of a better term, social experimentation, social engineering that the Obama administration is engaged in the military's culture, if you will, is also having a very deleterious effect. Would you talk about that a bit, if you would? Particularly, I'm thinking most immediately of this issue of putting women in combat. And now there's some talk about even drafting them to serve in that role if need be.
Yeah, the only thing that matters in warfare is winning. So any change to a force, whether it's a platform or the people involved, if it doesn't contribute to enhancing the ability of the force to win in direct combat with the enemy, then it's a bad decision. So I understand the motivation to apply many of these policies that, that are currently in discussion from a very egalitarian and a very merit-based approach, where regardless of your gender, it doesn't matter. Everybody should have an equal opportunity to participate in defending the country. And that's very noble. I mean, I understand that. But warfare is a human endeavor. You're dealing with people that are often operating outside of the normal boundaries that govern human behavior in a civil society. So it can be brutal, it can be austere, it's very physically intense, and the human element really gets amplified. So what we're expecting men and women in that kind of cauldron to do is to really hyper-discipline their natural inclinations in ways that no other avenue of life would call upon them to do. When you're in combat for days at a time, physically exhausted, and yet you still have to repel the next enemy assault or take the building, sheer physical power is really called upon. And so what we're doing is opening up job opportunities for an egalitarian perspective, and expecting that the people who want to rise to that challenge will also be able to perform. So if it's purely metrics-based and you can lift a heavy ammo can, then it shouldn't be a problem. But a purely metrics-based approach tends to ignore the human element and how men and women behave and operate, what their value systems are, and those kinds of things. So it's an extraordinary demand being placed on young men and women to alter their behaviors that have been millennia in the making in ways that no other walk of life calls upon them.
Dakota Wood, thank you. We've reached the end of a very important, very in-depth conversation about what challenges we're facing as a nation and the kinds of things that need to be done to assure we rise to them. The work you do at the Heritage Foundation is tremendously appreciated by me and I think all of our audience, Dakota, and as is your service in uniform. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again if you would very soon, and I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.